Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we're going to talk about the healing benefits of animals, how to pick the best support animal for you, as well as get the best advice for those who might be grieving the loss of their animal. My guest today, Shannon Kopp, is the author of Pound for Pound, a story of one woman's recovery and the shelter dogs who loved her back to life. Shannon holds an MFA in nonfiction writing, has written for CNN, Maria Shriver, The Huffington Post, Good Housekeeping, Bark Post, and more. Her story's been featured in People, NPR, CNN, Women's Health, and Psychology Today. Shannon is the founder and CEO of the Soul Pause Recovery Project, a nonprofit organization providing free, clinician-led eating disorder support groups, enhanced by the loving presence of therapy animals. Shannon is a national mental health advocate for Eating Recovery Center Pathlight and lives in Connecticut with her husband, sons, and wildly adorable rescue dog, Bella. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. I had the opportunity to see you speak recently at a conference and heard your personal recovery story, including the shelter dogs. And I thought a good starting place would be sharing your personal story with our listeners today.
Sure. It was so wonderful to connect at the conference. And I feel like I shared at this conference in particular, we were at more vulnerably than I ever have before, because it feels so important to me to get the word out about the healing power of animals, especially as a mom now. So at the conference, I talked about when I first got a job at the San Diego Humane Society. I was 24 years old, and for the past 8 years prior, I had been battling an eating disorder, bulimia, and depression. My father battled substance use disorder and other mental health challenges, including eating disorders, and tragically never recovered. And by the time I was 24, many doctors and clinicians and even treatment centers had tried to help me, but I just kept getting worse. And I also couldn't really tell anyone the truth of how bad it was. It felt so shameful to say what I was doing with food and to say out loud the dark thoughts I was having, which were suicidal. And I was convinced at that point that I was going to end up like my dad, that there really was no hope for me. But I had an incredible therapist. And she said, "I'm noticing something when you talk about treatment." And she was referring to a treatment center I had been at in the middle of the desert. I relapsed shortly after coming home from that treatment center, but I had experienced equine therapy there. She said, "Your eyes are doing this thing when you talk about the horses. I see light in your eyes. We have to do something about this light. There's hope there. I see hope when you talk about animals." And so she really guided me and my partner towards finding a job working with animals. And I ended up working at the San Diego Humane Society, where my job was essentially to write little match.com profiles for the dogs and cats and bunnies and rats and birds, animals of all kinds, even horses. So this is Fluffy. She's a couch potato. She'll hang out with you all night long while you eat your popcorn and be a great snuggle bug. This is Ryder. He will be your running buddy, on and on and on. That was my job. And one day, this dog came into our care named Buster, who had survived abuse and neglect and was brought in through a humane investigations case. And he was only 4, but he had severe arthritis in his legs. So his entire room was covered with blankets and he walked like an old man. And he even looked old, even though he was 4. He was a lab mix, yellow coat. He had a bit of an overbite, like he was smiling. And he just couldn't really walk that well. He would just try to stand up and he'd fall over. And one morning, I was feeling really scared because I came into work and I saw all these emails I hadn't gotten back to and all this work that I hadn't done because of the eating disorder, because of the depression. I was sure I was going to lose this dream job of mine, this job that I hadn't had for very long, but I was convinced I didn't deserve it maybe. And I was letting the animals down and everybody down. And so I just stepped away from my desk. I went to see Buster. It was before the Humane Society opened. And I just started crying and petting this dog. And I started experiencing suicidal ideation again. And then in the midst of these really dark thoughts, all of a sudden Buster stood up to his feet. And I was just kind of stunned because I wasn't used to him standing up. So he did it in a very, it felt like he was really trying. And so I put my arms around him to kind of steady him. And then he put his nose into my chest. And it felt to me like an invitation to hug him. And I leaned over him and I started just really petting him and crying into his coat. And somehow I didn't understand at the time. Now I do. Buster regulated my emotions in a really profound way. He calmed my body. He calmed my emotions. He pulled me out of these dark thoughts. And after only 5 minutes, just being really present with this incredible dog, I knew I needed to get more help. I knew that I needed to tell somebody about these dark thoughts I was having. And I knew I needed to get really honest with my therapist about the eating disorder. And that's what I did. And I wondered for a long time, how was it? Why was it that I couldn't access that thinking in therapy or in treatment or in the moments I needed to most when I was, you know, struggling in the kitchen or struggling in my bed? Why and how could an animal get me there to this clarity and willingness that I needed help? And that's what my journey has been ever since then. I'm now almost 40 and my whole life has been about learning about animals and really spreading the message that animals can be a profound tool in eating disorder recovery. My story started with Buster. That's when I feel like my recovery truly began. I then adopted my emotional support animal and worked with a lot of other animals who helped me fully recover from bulimia and depression. And that's my story.
Shannon, I have so many questions for you, and I know the listeners do too. So I'm going to try to narrow this down. And thank you for sharing that. That's actually not the story I heard at the conference. So I imagine that we all kind of know that, oh, you know, I've heard that dogs can tell when we're anxious or dogs can tell when we're depressed, but I didn't know why that was until seeing you speak. Is it true that when we're anxious or when we're depressed, we send off different pheromones? Is that a part of how the animal knows?
Yes, exactly. We send off pheromones. The animal can sense that. I mean, dogs have an incredible sensory system and they can sense with their nose, truly like our emotions. They also have something called mirror neurons where when we are feeling something, not that they feel it too, but that like, if we're really happy, suddenly, you know, when you see your dog's tail start to wag, that has to do with the neurons in their brain. So the way that energy is shared between a human and an animal, it's much more complex than that, but for time's sake. And then the other thing that they do simply because of their nature, the fact that they don't have this dialogue, right, going on in their head. Am I loved? Am I enough? Am I this? Am I that? The fact that they are just so present with you and that they can't really lie, you know, a dog is not going to be like, oh, I don't want you to see how stressed I am. They're just going to be stressed. Or I don't want you to see how sad I am. They're just going to be sad. And so there's just this kind of pure emotional expression. They are sentient beings in animals. And I think, and this is really just my personal experience, but witnessing their courage to be vulnerable, especially shelter dogs in particular, with their emotions helped me feel more comfortable with telling humans about my emotions. So sometimes I would tell the dogs, but it would be like, okay, I'm sitting here with this incredibly brave shelter dog who's been through so much, who's not putting on an act here, right, who is actually really anxious and shaking. And sometimes my emotional support animal who I adopted has a lot of anxiety. So sometimes she'd be shaking in a therapy session and then I'd be shaking, but I'd still be talking because Bella was there and I felt you know, and a lot of Dr. And I don't think we talked about this at the conference either, but Patricia Flaherty-Fichette, who's a board member at SoulPause, our nonprofit organization, she's done a lot of research between eating disorder patients and animals. And to sum up her research in a nutshell, it's that animals are a bridge for people with eating disorders to experience emotional regulation, so calming. And we knew that, you know, we know that in all ways. You can look at a fish and science shows that will help to calm you down, right? Okay. You can pet a turtle. It doesn't have to be a cute, fluffy dog. But for particular people with eating disorders, it helps increase a sense of safety. So it's a bridge to feeling safe with your treatment team or with the people that are trying to help you. It's a bridge to distress tolerance. So you will try fear foods and maybe, you know, go to this new doctor that you're scared of going to if the animal's by your side. And then it's also a bridge to expanding your identity beyond the eating disorder. So many of the people that she researched who were currently in eating disorder treatment centers at the time said, you know, I realize that I'm an animal person. I'm not just a person with an eating disorder. I'm not just a sick person. I'm a person who likes dogs or horses or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it didn't have directly so much to do with animals, but this opening up of identity also happens around animals.
That's a great way to think of it. And the other part of your story made me think about the suicidal ideation. And I know firsthand as a therapist that it can be really hard for clients to share that suicidal ideation. Of course, keeping it in the dark, you know, where it gains momentum isn't good either. Can you speak to why it's scary to share the suicidal ideation with a human, for example?
Yeah, I was scared that I'd be locked away somewhere. Mm-hmm. I guess I was really kind of exposed to a lot of, you know, the media and things you see about mental health. And it was a sign that I was like a failure because so many people were trying to help me. And yet here I was having these thoughts about giving up. And to hear yourself say it out loud can make it feel more real. Mm. So I think, you know, even Buster's presence helped me. I think another thing is I would experience that in moments of extreme distress. And what I've come to understand now, a lot of the free support groups that we offer through SoulPause, it's a nonprofit organization that provides clinician-led support groups with animals, are based on the framework of the neurosequential model, which basically says that our brains process, and this is the work of Dr. Bruce Perry, information sequentially, and that before we can reach the highest part of our brain, the cortex, what they call the learning brain, we have to be emotionally regulated. And this is probably nothing new to you, right? But we have to be emotionally regulated or else we're in that fight or flight part of our brain. And then a step further, we have to be connected. Then if we're regulated, and Dr. Perry calls it, it's a three-step process, regulate, relate, reason. If we are regulated and we are connected, then we can access that higher part of our brain that can problem solve, that can reason. And so I think that's what happened to me with Buster, is that he was so profoundly regulating. He calmed me in such a powerful way, a way that yoga never, I'm a huge yoga lover, huge book lover, huge meditation lover, but I never could really, nothing calms me like an animal. And I think that enabled my brain to slow down with those dark thoughts and get to, instead of fight or flight, I want to leave the world, to my cortex, my higher learning brain, and say, wait a second, is that the answer? Is that the answer? And it's not. It's not the answer, but it can feel like that.
I'm so glad that I asked you about that, but let me make sure I understand. Okay. So you've got regulate. Buster helps you regulate.
Yeah.
You've got relate. What is the relate part with Buster?
Feeling connected. Feeling connected. And that can be, and Dr. Perry's research, he's talking about it as, you know, you need to feel connected with the teacher if you're going to learn from the teacher, with the therapist, if any healing is going to take place. But there is the connection I felt with Buster was enough to get me to the higher part of my brain. And at SoulPause, we've changed it a little bit with Dr. Perry's approval. He is a wonderful human being. And we're so thankful he's helped us provide. He's an advisor to Soul Paws. This framework, we call it calm, connect, and then cultivate compassion instead of regulate, relate, reason, because in our workshops, we practice similar to what Buster and I did. We practice a calming, grounding meditation with animals. Then we practice pure connection with the animals. And then we work out of our learning brain to practice compassion for wherever we are in our eating disorder recovery.
I love that. And yes, I know some of what you're saying as a therapist, but I have never heard it be articulated in that way. It really makes a lot of sense. It feels like a lot of things just came together for me. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you went to a program in the desert. I can imagine. I think I've been to some on-site visits there and have witnessed the equine therapy, the therapy with horses. What are the most common animals used for therapy?
Yeah, so in treatment programs, it usually is equine therapy, but again, it really depends on where you are, and that can be, you know, the downside of it is it can be expensive to a center. So some programs have therapy dogs there. In my world, I see dogs used the most, but not so much as therapy dogs, but as emotional support animals. So okay. it's very confusing because there's lots of ways animals help their human friends. So there's emotional support animals like my dog Bella, who I've had for 13 years, who really provides emotional comfort to me and is allowed to come with me on my doctor's appointments, et cetera. I'm allowed to fly with her with a letter from my therapist, things like that. Okay. Then there are service animals, which help disabled people with specific tasks and are highly trained. And these are dogs. Then we have animal assisted therapy and animal assisted activities. So animal assisted therapy really has a goal and helps the participants, right? Whether they're doing an activity with a horse, maybe it is a center for autistic children and they have to reach for a set of tools and use the tools with the horse. It has a goal. Animal assisted activities, the way I understand it is they're activities that you do with the animals, but it doesn't have to be such a set goal. And this is like where we start and this is where we finish. I'm not an expert here. But what I see in my world, being a writer, being a mental health advocate, and what is most accessible to people are emotional support animals, and they're usually dogs, because it's quite easy to find an emotional support animal at your local shelter. You're looking for an animal that you feel a connection with, that is comforting to you by the way they look at you, by the way their tail wags, by the proximity that they have to you, if they're, you know, able to kind of get in your lap and ground you, things like that you're looking for. You're really just looking for a connection that feels special and comforting to you. And then you can apply online to have an emotional support animal, and the rest is history. And it's really helpful if you have a treatment team that also encourages you to incorporate your emotional support animal, ESA, they call it, into your daily life practices, which is what my therapist did. And so long answer is that usually the most common kind is dogs, but I think a lot of people think, oh, okay, you know, Shannon, you have a service dog. I actually don't. I have an emotional support animal and she's profoundly helpful to me.
Does Bella, for example, have to hold some kind of special training or certification to be an emotional support animal?
No.
Okay.
No,
it's like just, you determining.
I determine that. I do need letters from mental health providers or doctors to bring her on an airplane, for example, which if she was a service dog, I don't think I would need, right? Because service dogs are trained to help with very specific tasks that could be life or death related tasks, or just tasks that help people function throughout their day.
Does an animal-assisted therapy animal need specific training?
Yes. So that's a great question. So at Soul Pause, for example, we partner with different animal assisted therapy organizations. So when we did our talk at the conference where we met, you'll notice I with me were two miniature horses, right?
Yes.
And then three dogs. All of those animals had to go through training. I'm not as familiar with what the horses went through, to be honest. But I know for the dogs, they have to pass a canine good citizen test. It's pretty tough to be a therapy animal. Like I knew when I adopted my little poodle mix Bella, she wouldn't pass her test because part of the test is, you know, can the owner be here and the dog across the other on the other side of the room and just sit there? And Bella, being the anxious pup, she'd just like run to me, right? And so it really does take a certain kind of dog. I will say I've seen all breeds of dogs. Mm. Be therapy animals. We typically see, right, golden retrievers in labs, but I've seen pit bull mixes. I've seen German shepherds. I've seen corgis. I've seen chihuahuas even. And so it definitely just depends on the animal's ability to respond and perform in the training. And then those organizations usually go to like what we experienced was a bit unique. Usually these animals go into hospitals, right? They go into schools, they go into nursing homes. And at Soul Pause, they come to our support groups and they are a part of a animal assisted activity,
oh,
right?
Because nice.
we're not doing a specific goal at Soul Pause. We're having the animals be a comfort throughout the process. We're having them connect, but we're not saying like what you experienced at the treatment. Like I remember at the treatment center I went to, we had to guide a horse. We had to say, okay, think about your eating disorder and what are the things that are standing in the way of your recovery, and take things and make them symbols for those. So take this bucket of hay and make that. And for me, it was my relationship with my dad. Take this carrot and put it here. For me, that was diet culture, whatever. And I lined up all these things. Then I had to walk, guide the horse through a straight path without the horse getting distracted and munching on the carrots, munching on the hay. And it took me many times, but eventually we reached our goal. And that was really, again, something I can look back on when I feel discouraged about anything, not just eating disorders, and go, okay, this might take me some time, but I am going to do it, just like the horse. I think her name was Dixie at the treatment center. Dixie made it through all those roadblocks.
And what would a therapy session look like with an emotional support animal such as Bella? Like, what would that look like in the therapy room?
I am so glad. I have never been asked that before. And that is so special to reflect on because, you know, I waited. I was like the only person working at the San Diego Humane Society that did not have an animal of her own for a bit because I was still really deep in the eating disorder. And I knew that adopting an animal is bringing a family member into your home and it is a big responsibility. So I would always kind of have to make up something like, oh, it's my apartment or I'm just waiting for the, but I wanted one so bad, but I also was just so aware of how chaotic my life was and how I had to make some progress, and it was a really good motivator for me.
Oh, wow.
So I adopted Bella. You know, I kind of made an agreement with my therapist that we'd get Bella when I was 1 year free of eating disorder behaviors, which felt still like this was impossible, but I did make it. And I did bring her home. And I remember when I brought her to therapy, it was such a, the first time we were just, I remember my therapist having tears in her eyes, You know, because she was with me every step of the way to that goal, to get to that goal. And then I think we both thought Bella would just kind of like relax in my lap, but she was a puppy. So she, what I was talking about earlier, those mirror neurons, I think I felt excited and she was kind of excited. And so she was actually quite like distracting, to be honest, in our first session. But then, you know, I learned if I brought her like a bone, for example, she'd sit on the couch with me, right? So I'd put her beside me and I would just reach for her without even thinking about it when I was talking about the tough stuff, right? And when I also brought her to dietitian appointments, I would eat fear food. So foods that I was really scared of eating, or that my eating disorder told me I couldn't eat, with Bella there at my feet. She'd try to eat the foods too, but it was fine. And so a lot of it just looked like finally saying the hard stuff and doing the hard things that I just couldn't do, but knowing I had this loving, non-judgmental being right there with me who was not going to say, hurry up, Shannon, like enough already, like just eat the damn food, or who was not going to, she was never going to talk back to me. She was just going to love me. And she thought I was, you know, that there was nothing lacking or missing in me, yeah. Which all, that's all I could see, you know, around that time in my life. And so the fact that, you know, even if I had a difficult therapy session, sometimes I'd be petting her and then sometimes I'd start to feel really overwhelmed. So then, you know, I'd pick her up and I'd put her right in my lap and I'd hold the bone for her and she'd be gnawing on the bone and I'd have her in my lap. And it just was very, very grounding. And it gave me the courage to keep talking, which is really what I needed to do.
You know, there are so many of my clients that I wish could have an emotional support animal. And I know they wish that too, but because of their job or their housing situation, they're not able to. Do you have anything to say about how someone might have more contact with animals when they aren't able to have them in their home?
I have so much to say on that.
Oh, you do? Oh, good.
I relate to them, not in the sense that my job was preventing me, but my mental health was. I just was struggling to take care of myself. So how could I take care of an animal? But I know plenty of people whose jobs or living situations prevent it, or they're in treatment and they can't be with an animal. That's one of the reasons why I founded Soul Paws, so that we could have these workshops for patients in treatment that are missing their animals or maybe not in a place where they could adopt an animal. I think it's something to talk with your support team, your, you know, support group, your therapist about. But for me, I knew actually nothing about animal shelters. I grew up in a small town in Connecticut and I didn't know one person that had adopted a dog. And I grew up with a purebred Bichon Frise that we got from our babysitter's breader. And I kind of always thought animal shelters are these really sad and scary places I need to stay away from because they'll break my heart. And I didn't know until I started working in animal welfare that yes, it is sad that these animals don't have homes, but they are so much more than homeless animals. Even in the kennels, they have so much to offer us. So if you are able to volunteer at your local animal shelter, you can be a dog walker. Oh. And you can walk dogs. And those dogs, let me tell you, are going to love you. They are going to be so ecstatic when you arrive at their kennel. And yeah, it's hard putting them back in the kennel, but you know you did something. There's also a lot of shelters now, which I feel excited about, that are no-kill shelters. So you can leave knowing these animals will eventually find their home. These healthy and adoptable animals will find their home. And I am here to support them along the way. So there's not that extreme, and this is not in all places, right? But I was fortunate at the San Diego Humane Society. I had that knowledge, which I think made it feel a little bit, it was like a gentle launch into animal welfare for me. And really dog walking still, I actually just contacted my local shelter to see if I could do it, because it's in meeting all those different animals. There's something to be said too about just lots of different animals and all the things they can teach us and ways they can help us heal.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how important it is for the animal that you choose to be in alignment with everybody involved.
So important, because this animal is a part of your family. And what I would encourage, if you have time, lots of family discussion about, you know, what are we looking for? Are we looking for a puppy, right? Who is going to be a lot of work and a lot of energy and really bring so much puppy-like joy and chaos to our world? Or are we looking for, you know, a dog a little bit later in life who's well-trained, who's calmer? What kind of, you know, just discussions. But then I think in a personal level, journaling on it and asking yourself, who is my, I call it my soul pet. Who is the animal I need for my soul right now? What does she look like? What what is her size? Where, what does she like to do? How does she support me? And maybe it's because she's going to get me outside. Maybe it's because she's going to sleep by my side and share a pillow with me and be super tight and just kind of start to envision if there was an animal that could really be a companion to my heart and soul, who could bring so much comfort and connection to my life. You know, do I have any visuals of it? Do I have any kind of, does anything come to me? I also think you have to just trust your gut. I actually did a lot of that reflecting with my therapist about what is the dog. And we really landed on like a smaller dog that I could be really mobile with, so that I could take the dog like to, and in San Diego, it's a lot more relaxed, but you know, I could take her to restaurants when I, you know, was eating, I could take her, it would be easy for me to bring her everywhere. And so I knew it needed to be a small dog. I knew it needed to be somebody who was super snuggly that I could hold. But the dog I had picked out, when I met that dog, something in my gut didn't feel right. And then Bella was there just pawing at me and just being so like, so insistent about me holding her. Like, you are meant for me. You are meant for me. I am meant for you. It is undeniable. And so I just believed her, and I trusted my gut. And so some of it is that, you know, and just having a conversation with your family too. Like, is anyone, what is your gut saying today with among these animals?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I knew that going to see your talk at the conference was going to be a really important one for me to see, because at that time, a couple months ago, we were losing our dog of 10 years. And a colleague of mine recently said that the loss of an animal is typically a child's first experience with loss, or the practice of loss. And I know, you know, as natural as loss is, I know that we're seldom ready to admit that it's just a normal part of life. Even though that's hard for me to admit as well. What is your best advice for someone grieving the loss of their dog?
Oh, well, first, I am so sorry for the loss of your dog.
Thank you.
And knowing a little bit about you, I'm so thankful that your daughter has a mother that holds space for her grief, because your colleague is so right. It is often a child's first experience with grief. And I think the sad thing about pet loss in our society is that the depth of the relationship a person has with their pet, the power of the human animal connection, is often misunderstood or not given enough credit.
Right,
and
I agree.
So people might, you know, for a few days say, oh, I'm so sorry, but then kind of you get this feeling like, okay, so I'm just supposed to move on. I'm just, or when are you getting your next pet? When are you doing this? And da, da, da. And it is such a profound loss. So I think just holding space for that grief, especially for a child, for as long as that grief lives, which might be forever.
Yes.
So you might be with your child when she's 45 and you still are talking about this animal and what a loss it was at the time. And it's so important to honor that. At the Humane Society, the president of the Humane Society, I lost my childhood dog before I started there. And to make a long story short, he would visit every employee who lost an animal on the anniversary of that pet's death every year following.
Wow.
So all my years I was at the Humane Society, on that date in May, the president would show up at my desk and say, I'm so sorry for your loss, as a symbol that this loss will never leave you.
Right, right.
And for anyone who's grieving a pet, the guidance would be to, in the same way if you lost a human in your life that you would need a lot of support, is to build up that support. Don't underestimate the power of an animal in your life and the loss, and don't try to go it alone. There is an amazing pet loss support group at sdhumane.org that is now offered virtually and led by a clinician that I couldn't recommend enough. And lots of humane societies and organizations now offer these, and they're virtual, which is one of the benefits of our now virtual world. And so please find support and honor the grief. I think, you know, for me, my sister had Sugar's collar and some of her fur. I have like a little shrine to a lot of the animals I've lost. And I try to not try to push the memories away, mm-hmm. even when they make me sad, but to go and spend time with that animal's memory and spirit when I feel sad, even though sometimes it makes me feel more sad, I'll be honest, but it's like, I just believe that every animal I've loved and lost has fundamentally changed my heart and made me the mother I am today, the advocate I am today. And so I like to think that they're never truly gone. I feel like they're a part of me forever. And I feel really protective of holding space for them as well. So holding space for my grief, but also the animals. So I think one common thing you'll hear when you lose a pet is people will start like sending you dog pictures and like, oh, get this one. And, you know, to feel okay setting boundaries and saying, you know, I'm just taking my time with this, and to not feel rushed, to really take your time talking as a family, figuring out what feels best. And then, you know, moving forward, one other activity you could do is to ask your, I think there's a bridge between all the animals we love. So asking the dog that has passed, who do you envision coming next mm-hmm. in lives? What furry friend do you envision?
And I love that.
Because your dog clearly loved you and wanted the best for you always, I bet they might give a really surprising and beautiful response.
Thank you, Shannon. And we definitely wanted to wait till we were not so much in that first stage of grief, but more at a place where we could look back and think fondly of Gracie, our dog.
Aww.
And so we're entering there. And I imagine that's also more fair to the dog that you're going to adopt when you're in that space versus the very first stage of grief.
Yes.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for sharing your recovery story and for normalizing conversations about mental health struggles.
Thank you.
And for all of the love you've given to the hundreds of rescues that are so desperate to be loved and have so much love to give and give us so much love. I just am so happy to learn more about your work, and thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a gift.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. Today actually marks the 3-year anniversary of the podcast. I'm taking a short hiatus, but I'll be back with episode 38 at the beginning of August. And in the meantime, I'd love to hear listener ideas for future Therapy Rocks topics. Please feel free to send those to me through my website at www.signadarpinian.com. We'll see you in a couple months.